that I co-authored with a clinical psychologist who lives not far from Shavasti Abbey, where I live. And he's kind of a Buddhist, the psychologist is. He really resonates with a lot of the Buddhist teachings, but he's not quite sure about rebirth. But he's getting it. So we wanted to write a book that is for a secular audience, not necessarily a Buddhist audience. A book that anybody could read, no matter what their religion. So we wrote this book together. It was an interesting endeavor because I wanted to write more about rebirth, and he didn't want me to. And he wanted to write more about the brain, and I didn't want him to do that. So we each compromised a little bit, but we, you know, wrote a book that we're both very happy with. It was published in the U.S. under the title An Open-Hearted Life, with a different cover, but the contents is the same, should you want to get a copy. So, in the book, you know, we, both of us, really wanted to communicate to people the importance of compassion, and also to really describe accurately what compassion was, because a lot of people have misconceptions about compassion. So from a Buddhist viewpoint, compassion is simply the wish for someone to be free of misery and the causes of misery. Okay? Very simple definition. The meaning of that definition requires quite a bit of unpacking. So we want others to be free of misery or suffering. What does that mean? What is misery or suffering? Now I think all of us can agree that when our body is ill or our body is injured, that's suffering. I think we can all agree that when our mind is unhappy, that that's also suffering. Okay. You know, we'll all agree that very gross physical and verbal, physical and mental pain is suffering. But the Buddha also spoke about other kinds of what he called suffering. But he didn't use the word suffering. He used the Pali and Sanskrit word dukkha. Suffering is not a very good translation of the word dukkha. Yeah? Because we think, oh, dukkha just means that you're in pain all the time. Yeah. So then people say, well, what's this thing about Buddha saying that we live in the middle of suffering? I'm happy. You know? That's pessimistic to say we're suffering all the time. We aren't. So that's why translating it as suffering is not accurate. A better translation would be something like unsatisfactory or incomplete. In other words, our situation isn't totally satisfactory. If your situation were completely satisfactory, you wouldn't be here tonight. Why did we come here? Because we're trying to learn something to improve the quality of our life. So the Buddha spoke about three kinds of dukkha, three kinds of unsatisfactory conditions. So the first is what we just talked about, the very gross pain. The second one is when we seem to be happy. Okay? So, for example, if you're sitting here in the talk for a long time, your back hurts, your knees hurt, when the talk is over, you feel so happy to stand up. And standing up is happiness. But if standing up were real happiness, the more you stood up, the happier you would be. But after a while of standing, what happens? You want to sit down again. So you sit down, and initially, oh, I feel so good, I'm happy. But then you keep sitting down, and you want to stand up again. So when we look at these situations that we call worldly pleasure or worldly happiness, what's actually happening in them is something that was a big suffering has decreased, and a small suffering is just beginning. And that's what we call happiness. So in the example, the big suffering of sitting with your neck and your back and your knees hurting, when you stand up, that goes down. But the misery of sitting at that moment is small. So we call it happiness. But the more we sit, the more sitting becomes standing. The more, when we first stand, we feel good. But the more we stand, standing becomes painful. So if we look at anything that we usually call pleasure, it has this dynamic. So for example, when we're hungry, when you're hungry, you start eating, I feel so good to start eating. Why do you say I feel good, I have happiness? Because the suffering of hunger has gone down. And the suffering of being too full is just starting. But if eating in and of itself were true happiness, the more you ate, the happier you would be. But what happens when you eat a lot?
My stomach hurts.
We eat too much. Okay? So we can see that eating in and of itself isn't happiness. Because if you keep doing it, it becomes overt suffering. But we call eating happiness at that time when the suffering of hunger has gone down and the suffering of being too full is just beginning. You get what I mean? So it's like almost anything you think of in your life that you call happiness has this dynamic. When you apply for a job that you want and you get that job, you see, wow, I'm so happy. I got the perfect job that I really like. But as you continue to do that job, you do it 1 year, 2 years, 20 years, 30 years, is it still bringing you happiness? You start to look forward to retirement, or you want to change jobs and do something different. So that's another example. When the suffering of unemployment went down and the suffering of our job was small, we call that happiness. But if working that job were true happiness, The longer we worked it, the happier we would be. But that's not what happens. Okay? So after a while, it's like, oh, I've been doing this job so long, I want to quit. So that's called the dukkha of change. It's the second kind of dukkha, the second kind of unsatisfactory condition. It's called the dukkha of change because something that we thought was pleasant, it variably becomes unpleasant if you keep doing it. Then the third kind of dukkha is called the dukkha of pervasive conditioning, or you could say pervasive dukkha of conditioning. That might be better. Okay. And what that means is that we have a body and mind that are conditioned by afflictions such as ignorance, anger, and attachment, and polluted karma. So we have this body and mind that are produced by ignorance. Do you think something that's produced by ignorance is going to bring everlasting happiness? No, it's not. Because ignorance already implies something isn't right. Okay. So what is it that's not right about our body and mind? Well, we take a body that gets born, gets old, gets sick, and then dies. Is that your favorite thing to do? Especially, you know, the get old and sick and die part of it. None of us look forward to that. Even birth, actually, for the baby and for the mother, is rather painful. And yet, because we have this kind of flesh and bone body, we're stuck in this kind of situation due to ignorance. And we're also stuck with a mind that's full of attachment and anger, resentment, grudge holding, and jealousy, and all sorts of mental factors that actually make us quite unhappy during our lives. And so we take this body and mind, not by choice. After we die from the previous life, it's not like we sat on top of some cloud and said, oh, I'm going to get reborn. What should I get reborn as? Who should I get reborn as? No. You know, in the previous life when we died, we were pushed by our afflictions, our ignorance, and so on, by our and then pushes us, propels us to take another rebirth where we have a body that gets old and sick and dies, and a mind that is moody and dissatisfied. Okay. So that's another kind of unsatisfactory condition that we have in life. Just the kind of rebirth we take. We weren't born in Amitabha's pyramid. We were born in Amitabha's pyramid, but in a different situation. We wouldn't have a mind that is always complaining and unhappy. Okay. We would have a different physical situation too. But we were born with this body and this mind that aren't completely satisfactory. So the Buddha talks about compassion meaning wanting someone to be free of dukkha and its causes. When he says dukkha, he's referring to all three kinds of dukkha. We usually only think of the first one. We think of compassion being giving food to somebody who's hungry, medicine to someone who's sick, clothes to someone who's too cold, a place to live to someone who's homeless, friendship to somebody who's lonely. We think of those kinds of dukkha, and compassion, calling to ameliorate that situation. And that's good if we do that. Definitely, it's a practice of generosity. But that's only one type of dukkha. And when the Buddha talked about compassion, he was talking about the other two types also. Okay. So the second type of dukkha, changeable dukkha, refers to worldly happiness. How often do you have compassion for people who are successful in the world? People who are rich, who are famous, who are athletic and very physically attractive. People who are powerful, people who are intelligent. People that you might be jealous of sometimes. Do you cultivate compassion for those people? Or do you cultivate jealousy and anger at them? Okay? We have to look here. Because often, the poor, the sick, yes, we have compassion. But some rich person who's very selfish, we don't have any compassion. You know who it's really hard for me to cultivate compassion for? Donald Trump. Not only because of his values, which I consider very harmful, but it's hard for me to have compassion for people who are arrogant because they're so rich. It's hard for me to have compassion for people who are powerful and oppress others and cause other people problems instead of helping them. It's hard for me. Wait, you're rich, you're famous. Why don't you do something useful with your life instead of causing, violence and bigotry and racism? I never think of Donald Trump as suffering until I really sit and think about it. And then I think, wow, somebody who thinks like he does must be very miserable. Somebody who has that kind of racism, misogyny, bigotry, that kind of person is not very happy. Someone who has to live at the penthouse of a Manhattan skyscraper with security guards all around so that nobody disturbs him, that person is not very happy. They have a lot of fear. Did you ever think of rich and famous people as suffering? You really think of them, I'm not sure here, but in my country, people idolize the movie star. private lives, so many problems. Marilyn Monroe, I think she committed suicide, didn't she? Elizabeth Taylor had, what was it, 6 or 8 husbands. You know, Prince died of a drug overdose, so did Michael Jackson. Were these people happy? No. Somebody who has a drug and alcohol problem is not happy. They may be rich and famous, athletic and good looking, but not happy. So when we're cultivating compassion, it's not just for the poor and the sick. It's also for the rich and the famous. You know, I had one experience one time that really helped me in this regard. Bill Gates, his best friend was dying in Seattle, and the best friend and his wife were Buddhists, and so I was asked to come and help while he was dying. And afterwards, the memorial service was at Bill Gates' estate, so I went there. I was in charge of leading the memorial service. And, you know, Bill Gates is one of the richest people in the world. But when I left there, I went to take a walk. And at that time, I thought, wow, Bill Gates and his family can't just take a walk down the street. I mean, if you're that rich and that famous, you can take a walk down the street. You'd be mobbed. Yeah. His children have to have bodyguards. Can you imagine somebody, you know, kidnaps Bill Gates' child and holds him for a ransom of how many million dollars? And I thought, wow, I'm nobody. And I'm free. I can walk down the street. And nobody else looks at me. Nobody else cares. Yeah. Bill Gates doesn't have that kind of freedom. And that's what made me really, you know, start thinking, I have to practice more having compassion for the rich and the famous, because they have certain kinds of suffering that the rest of us don't have. Then, so that's the second, cultivating compassion for people with the second kind of suffering, changeable, dukkha. Then, for the third kind, just the dukkha of being born in this kind of body. Because born, old, thick, and dies. And this kind of mind that's full of afflictions. And this is something that all of us suffer from. Rich or poor, illiterate or well-educated, whatever your social class is, we all suffer from this. But most people don't even think about this as suffering. They just say, well, I have this body, I have this mind, let's just get on with life and try and be happy. And they don't question, why am I born? What's the meaning of my life? Is there an ultimate solution to this problem of having this kind of body and mind? So many people don't even think about that. They're just trying to be happy day by day. But they get some happiness day by day. They have some misery day by day. And at the end of their life, what happens? They die. And everything that they thought brought them happiness stays here. And their consciousness, together with all the karma they created, goes on to the next life. And when I think about that kind of situation, you know, it's like, wow, that's really suffering. You live this whole life just trying to eke out some happiness, but you never think of creating virtue to prepare for a good future life. You never, you know, people don't encounter the Dharma, so they don't know what to practice and abandon their own path. They're just trying to get through their lives, but no matter how they do it, they always die at the end. My parents were like that. And I remember, you know, when my first my mom died and then my dad died, going into their room, there's all their stuff, and there's all their kids, and they couldn't take any of it with them. Yeah. They went on just with their karma. And of course, their mental afflictions. And that, I think, that's maybe the greatest kind of suffering. And yet most sentient beings suffer from that. And they don't even realize it. So when we're talking about compassion, and maybe eliminate the dukkha, the suffering of other living beings, it's all three kinds that we want to eliminate. So if we can eliminate the first kind by giving people food, clothing, medicine, and shelter, we can eliminate the second kind, maybe sometimes, by, you know, well, you know what, eliminating the second kind is really difficult. Because to eliminate the second kind of dukkha, that dukkha of change, where happy situations change into miserable ones, now, we don't have much control about that. We can't change the external situation in people's lives. Maybe what we can help them with is creating an attitude of contentment or satisfaction. That might help them be a little bit happier. And then for the third kind of dukkha, being born with a body and mind under the influence of ignorance and polluted karma, the way we help beings be free of that is by teaching them the Dharma. Because when they then practice the Dharma, they can create virtue and abandon virtue. They can generate wisdom that overcomes ignorance. They become capable of freeing their own minds. Okay. So compassion is something that's very vast. To wish others to be free of dukkha and its causes, it's very vast. It's not simple. It's not one simple answer of, I wish I had enough money to give everybody what they want. Because even if you give everybody what they want, they still have the dukkha of change and the pervasive dukkha of conditioning. And they're not going to be everlasting happy. The only way people can have lasting happiness is through practicing the Dharma and freeing their own mind from
from a fisher's apartment.
That's the only way.
So we're going to help people in that broad way.
Then we have some work to do on ourselves to become capable of benefiting. Otherwise, it's really like the blind leading the blind. No, we're not going to get anywhere together. But even if we can't solve all sentient beings' dukkha and misery immediately, just having the wish that they are free from it already is extremely virtuous, extremely wonderful. That mind of compassion is the aim of our one mind. Okay. His Holiness the Dalai Lama talks a lot about compassion. And yeah, he makes clear that compassion and pity are two different things. Pity is when we feel sorry for someone. Yeah. Oh, you poor person, you're impoverished, you don't have money, you're living on the street, I feel so sorry for you. Yeah. Oh, you poor person, you're sick, I feel sorry for you. That's pity, okay? That's not compassion. Because when we pity somebody, we're kind of on the high ground, the safe ground, looking down on someone who's more unfortunate than we are, and with a little bit of condescension, you know, saying, oh, I feel sorry for you. But compassion doesn't have somebody being higher feeling sorry for somebody who's lower. Real compassion is between equals. Okay? So real compassion is, I understand your misery in the same way that I understand my own misery. And suffering is suffering no matter whose it is, mine or yours. And if I have the ability to help, I'll do it. Okay. So compassion is given from one equal person to another. Shantideva, in his book, The Bodhi, Engaging in the Bodhisattva Deeds, describes this very clearly. And he gives an analogy that has made a very deep impression on me. The analogy of how we should help others. Okay? If we're walking along the road and we step on a foot, or a piece of glass, we reach down and with our hand we pull the thorn out of our foot. You know, wash it off, put a bandage on, and keep going. The hand helps the foot automatically because the hand and the foot are part of one organism, in this case, us. Now why would we help another living being? Sometimes we don't feel like we're part of the same organism. You're different. Your life is messy. Your life is wretched. I'm going to help you. Sometimes we look at it that way, don't we? Yeah. And that's because we don't see ourselves and the other person
as part of the same organism called living beings. We saw ourselves that we're all part of this one thing called living beings. Then we would help others just very quickly, very easily, like the hand helps the foot. Okay. So we have to train our mind to see how all of us are really related. We're not little islands unto ourselves. We're very much related, and everybody equally wants happiness, and everybody equally wants to be free of suffering. There's no difference in us in that respect. So when we help others, we should do so just on an equal basis like that. So for example, when the foot of the hand pulls the thorn out of the foot, the hand doesn't go, "Stupid foot, you stepped on a thorn. I've told you many times before to look where you're going. You don't listen to my advice. You stepped on a thorn again. Aren't you happy, stupid foot, that you have me, the magnificent hand, who is so kind and compassionate, that now I am going to bend over and pull the thorn out of your foot? Aren't you grateful, foot? You should be grateful, because I'm being very kind and compassionate to you. So you better speak well about me to other people. And when I ask you to do a favor later on, you better do it." The hand doesn't relate to the foot that way, does it? The hand and the foot are part of the same organism. It just bends down, pulls the thorn out, bandages the foot, and goes on. So in the same way, we should help other living beings. In a very natural way, because we're all part of the same organism as human life. So instead of saying to somebody, "You know, I gave you advice about how important it was to go to school and then have a good career, and you didn't listen to me, and now you don't have any money and you're coming to ask me for money, you slob." Instead of talking that way to somebody, help them like the hand helps the foot. Now, what does it mean to help somebody? Okay, the hand helps the foot, it pulls out the thorn. When you have a relative who is an alcoholic, and comes to you asking for money, is it compassionate to give them money? It's not, is it? Because you know that they're going to misuse the money and do something that harms themselves and harms others. So being compassionate doesn't mean we always do what other people want us to do. Okay? This is very important. Being compassionate doesn't mean we say yes to everything people want. Why? Because sometimes people are very confused and very ignorant, and they want what is going to be harmful to them. Many of you are parents, right? Many of you are parents. When your child comes to you and says, I want this, I want that. Do you give your child everything they want? No. Why not? Well, first of all, we can only offer what's in our means. But even if you were fantastically rich, would you give your child everything they wanted? No. Because if you did, your child would become a total brat and wouldn't be able to function in society. Yeah. If your child is always used to getting whatever they want, then when they're with other people, they're going to say, I want this, I want that, and expect other people to give it to them. And they're not going to know how to deal with frustration. And they won't understand the value of money and how hard people have to work to get the money, to get things. So as a parent, sometimes the kindest thing you need to do for your child is to say no. And it may sometimes be very hard. But when you're thinking about the long-term benefit of your child, then you know that you have to raise them in such a way that they can deal with frustration. You have to raise them so that they appreciate the value of money and the value of hard work. You have to raise them so that they consider other people's feelings and needs and don't go through life thinking that they're the king of the universe and should get everything they want. Because they're going to not have very good relationships with other people if they start acting that way. Okay? So it's a good example, isn't it? You know, as a parent, out of compassion, sometimes you say no. Even when it's hard for you to say no. Sometimes your child made a mistake, you know. Now, if your child's 9 or 10 years old, you may want to help them out of that mistake. But when your child is 30 years old and did something really dumb that they should know not to do, are you being kind by stepping in and rescuing them? You want to help them because you can't bear to see them suffer. But is it kind to rescue them so that they don't learn how to deal with situations themselves? What I see, yeah, at the Abbey is we have sometimes young people who come to stay with us. And they do very well. And then one day they wake up on the wrong side of the bed and they say, I want to leave. And they call their parents. One time somebody called his father who lived in another state and said, I want to leave, come get me. His father drove 3 days to get to the Abbey to come get his son and take him. And those of us who are older who live in the community, we were saying that when we were that age, if that happened to us, our parents would not come rescue us. Our parents would say, you chose that situation, now you deal with it. You find a way to be happy there while you're there. I'm not stopping my life to drive 3 days to pick you up. so just seeing the difference between the generations, it's really made me appreciate more the way my parents raised me. Because I couldn't go whining to them. I had to be an adult. Whereas some of these young people, they just, Mom, Dad, I want something, come. As if Mom and Dad are their servants. That's not healthy, that's not helpful. So we definitely want to be kind, but we don't want to spoil people. And give them false expectations, or make them, brats. Do you know the word brat? A popular word, brat. I mean, somebody who's spoiled, I want this, I want that. I'm the center of the universe. So compassion, it entails a lot of wisdom to be compassionate. It doesn't just mean, oh, you're suffering, my heart bleeds for you, I'll do anything you want. It's not melodramatic like that. It has wisdom. What does this person need at this moment in order to grow? How can I help this person in the long term? And we all know that sometimes to help somebody in the long term, we have to risk their getting mad at us. Okay? For example, if you have a very good friend, and then your friend starts to gamble, and they lose a lot of money, the family money that's supposed to go for their children's education, or even the money to pay the mortgage. And so your friend is gambling and losing money and harming the family. Do you just let that person keep doing that? Yeah. You can't really let them keep doing it, can you? Because they're a really good friend and you love them and care about them. And you know that they're process of making a huge mistake. You also know that if you go and talk to them and say, I see you gambling a lot, and I think that's damaging to the family, you may also know that that person may get mad at you because they don't want to admit that they have a gambling problem. But if you're really a good friend, you're going to have to go and talk to your friend and say, I've just been watching, I've noticed that you're gambling and losing money, the family is getting harmed. How can I help you? Because I care about you. I don't want to see you, go down the slippery slope and make a mess. And when you do that, you do it out of compassion. And that person may just get mad at you. But if they do, you don't take it personally, because in your heart you know that you did what was right. And even if that person doesn't follow your advice right then and there, you've planted the seed. And maybe when they get desperate enough, then they'll remember your advice. Because maybe you said to them, you know, because now people are talking about gambling addictions, that it's, you know, an addiction. And they have centers where people can get treated for that addiction. So, you know, your friend may have initially been upset with you when you mentioned that, but after some time, they realize, you know, I've got to change, and then they remember your advice. Have you ever had that happen in your life? Said something to somebody that you cared about, and they got mad at you because of it? But you knew that it was important that you said that. That you said that for their benefit, not for your own. And so if that happens, you can feel confident because you acted with compassion and wisdom. And the person's mad, it doesn't matter. Yeah. You have inner strength. You can bear that. Because we're all trying to be bodhisattvas, aren't we? We're all bodhisattvas in training. We want to be like Kuan Yin. Don't you want to be like Kuan Yin? Huh? It's not a heavy responsibility, it's a total delight. You think Kuan Yin wakes up in the morning and says, oh God, always sent inmates who've been praying to me all night long, they want that. I sit down to help them, but you know, this morning I'm just too tired, I want to go back to bed. He sent inmates who are driving me crazy. Do you think that happens to Kuan Yin? No. Yeah. Why not? Because Kuan Yin's mind is much bigger than our mind. Our mind is so narrow. Our mind is, I just care about myself and my own happiness. I don't want to stretch myself to do anything for anybody else, even a little bit. We're so narrow, aren't we? There's this whole big world. There's more than 7 billion human beings on this planet. And who do we care about? One of them, who coincidentally happens to be me. That's really small-minded, isn't it? 7 billion human beings. When you add the animals and the fish and the insects, zillions of living beings on this planet. And we only care about one. That attitude is not going to lead to happiness. Yeah, that selfish attitude is not going to lead to happiness. So we have to open our heart and care about others. The more you care about others, the easier it is to help them. And then helping them doesn't become some big, heavy responsibility. It becomes delight. They say that when a bodhisattva, like Kuan Yin or Samantabhadra or Manjushri, hears somebody say, give me something, or help me, that this bodhisattva's gone, wow, I I can go help somebody now. I can go give somebody something. That's how happy they are. But we only get wisdom and compassion if we practice. If we say it's too heavy of a responsibility, then we're not going to practice. You know what that's like? If you have a little kid, yeah, and you want your kid to go to university, and your child says, oh, it's too much of a responsibility to go to university. I'm only going to go to kindergarten and then quit. Yeah? What are you going to say to your kid? You're going to say, it's okay. Go to kindergarten. You'll learn something in kindergarten. Then you can go to first grade. You'll be ready for first grade. Then in first grade, you'll learn some more. And you can go to second grade. Then you can learn some more. And soon, after a number of years, then it'll be time for you to go to university. And it will be really easy for you in university because you've spent all that time preparing and learning. So it's the same thing here. We have to prepare and learn how to be compassionate, how to have wisdom. And the more we do, then the easier it becomes. Yeah. Otherwise, if we give up, say, it's just too much. You know, becoming a bodhisattva is too much responsibility, too much, too hard. It's a pain in the neck. I don't want to be a bodhisattva. Then what would happen if all the bodhisattvas and all the Buddhas said that to us? Where would you be if Kuan Yin and Manjushri and Samantabhadra and Sakyamuni Buddha all said, these sentient beings are too much, they're a pain in the neck, I don't want to help them. I'm going to stay in my own nirvana. It's so blissful in my own nirvana. Yeah, these beings, let them learn for themselves. I can't be bothered. Then where are you going to be? Yeah. If all the bodhisattvas give up on us, where are we going to be? Nobody will teach us. Nobody will help us. We'll just create tons of negative karma and have one more will rebirth after the next. So if the bodhisattvas don't give up on us, why should we give up on others? We should. We should develop compassion slowly. Develop wisdom slowly. If we do this, you know, in a concise and methodical way, it won't be difficult to be a bodhisattva. Okay? So, I think we have time for a few questions. You want to ask something? You mean which order? You want to develop both together. You develop some compassion, then you develop some wisdom, then some more compassion, then some more wisdom. You need to develop both of them separately, but you need to alternate between the two when you're developing them. So it's not like you just develop compassion, and only after you have compassion do you develop wisdom. It's not like that. You do some compassion, some wisdom. But there's different practices. The practices you do for to develop compassion are not the same ones you do to develop wisdom.
So how do we do that? Because without these skills, all of the intentions are hang up more perfectly. So we need, how do we develop wisdom?
How do we develop wisdom? The first kind of wisdom is the wisdom understanding karma and its effects. So what I talked about during the retreat, yeah, how to create the causes of happiness and avoid the causes of suffering. You listen to those teachings, you think about them, you meditate on them, you develop, you practice them in your life. And that's the first kind of wisdom we need to develop, is the wisdom of how karma and its effects function. The more you develop that wisdom, then when you look at yourself and send your beings, the more you have compassion. Because you see that people often, you know, do non-virtuous things in their attempt to be happy because they lack that wisdom. So you have compassion for them, for lacking that wisdom. You want to be able to give them that.
All right.
bodhicitta and compassion.
Okay. So the difference between bodhicitta and compassion. Compassion is a cause of bodhicitta. Okay. Compassion wants to help, wants others to be free from their dukkha. On the basis of wanting to remove dukkha and give sentient beings happiness. On that basis, then we develop the intention, the motivation to become a fully awakened Buddha. That intention, that motivation is bodhicitta. So first we have compassion, then we develop the wish to become fully awakened so that we can actualize our compassionate motivation. That intention for full awakening is bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakening. Citta means both mind and heart. Okay, so it's the heart or mind aspiring for awakening. Okay, and let's sit quietly for a couple of minutes and meditate and think about the three kinds of dukkha that I mentioned and cultivate compassion for other people. Okay, so we'll do this for a few minutes before we take it. Let's rejoice at the air we created this evening. The air everybody here created. Let's rejoice also at the merit and the love and the compassion of all the Buddhists and Bodhisattvas.